baby, what's happening? How you doing? You, once you have a man with no legs, you never go back, baby. I know what you're thinking. You see Paul getting best? We can make it, baby. Me and you. You bitch.
Roll sound, Scotty.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape.
Trailer.
I had the most absurd nightmare. I was poor and no one liked me.
I know what you're thinking. You see Paul getting best? We can make it, baby. Me and you.
Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy are trading places.
Help! Help!
Anna wants your bag, man.
Help! 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 Help!
I'll bet that man could run our company as well as your young Woodthorpe.
Are we talking about a wager, Randolph?
Is there a problem, officer?
Oh, Woodthorpe. I'm glad your parents are not alive to see this.
Wait, now this is totally preposterous. I'm not a thief.
Here we are, William.
Take off your clothes.
You are making a career decision here.
Take off your clothes.
Did you hear what this man said to me? I have witnesses. This man is physically threatening me.
Hey, Randy, Morty, this is nice. I like this.
We are commodities brokers, William. Commodities are agricultural products, like wheat, which is used to make bread, pork bellies, which is used to make bacon, which you might find in a bacon and lettuce and tomato sandwich.
I'm considering going long on April wheat. What do you think, Valentine?
Freeze, Slimeball!
Moi?
Put that gun away at once, Winthorpe. You lost your mind?
Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Murphy. They're not just getting rich, they're getting even.
Do you have any better ideas?
Yeah, you know, it occurs to me that the best way you hurt rich people is by turning them into poor people.
Dan Aykroyd. Eddie Murphy. Ralph Bellamy.
We've got to get Wilson and tear up the sale.
Don Amici.
Randolph, this isn't Monopoly money we're playing with.
Denham Elliott.
What a scumbag.
And Jamie Lee Curtis.
By the way, food and rent, not the only things around here that cost money. You sleep on the couch.
Trading Places. It's a very funny business.
Southdown in April of 142!
Oh, we've got the pregnant pause now.
Oh?
Before it all kicks off.
Killing you, Spurs.
I'm recording the Skype thing, so we can kick in at any time. But do you want me to do a formal introduction, or
we might as well be professional?
What, in 10 years, when have we ever been?
We can start now.
Start now.
Don't have to be crazy to work here. We've been chatting for the last 20 minutes. We'll take this as the introduction. Hello, how you doing?
I'm all right. Yeah.
Charlie, Paul, Scott. There's Charlie. Okay. 10th anniversary. We're still working through our re-reviews of favourite movies and our favourite guests and podcasters.
That's coming next week.
Yes.
Oh, look at his little face. Sorry. He was crestfallen. Look.
Good word.
At the end of a Skype connection is my co-host from Real Britannia, Stephen. Hello, mate. How are you doing?
I'm very happy to be here on the second best podcast that you do.
Yeah, exactly.
Scathing.
And also throwing a curveball by reviewing a Christmas movie in the middle of August.
Yeah, but we do know that by the time everything's done and editing and release orders and stuff, this will be released at Christmas time. So.
Next year, yeah.
Yeah.
Be out in time for Kwanzaa.
You're having a laugh. There's no chance at the moment. Such a backlog at the moment of stuff to do. Trading Places. Now, I looked at my Letterboxd account, and the last time I watched it was 10 years ago when we reviewed it. Now, were you two both here for that?
I was.
Yes, I do remember.
Yeah, right. I think there was five of us.
five.
Not for four.
So that was it our Christmas special, or was it just a random...
I think it was a Christmas.
I don't think it was.
No, I don't think it was.
Didn't we do Die Hard at the same time?
No, that was the year after.
It falls into that category of where you would dispute whether it's an outright Christmas film, because this isn't a particularly...
It's just filmed over Christmas.
Well, I think it's incidental. It's not incidental, sorry. It's part of the plot as opposed to...
Because of the New Year. Yeah.
The New Year aspect is crucial to the stock exchange.
Let's ask our guest. Stephen, Christmas movie or not?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. I'm surprised there's even a debate about it. To be fair,
it's categories, though,
isn't it? You've got Dan Aykroyd dressed up as Santa Claus. I mean, eating salmon. So how much more Christmassy can you get, really?
It does feel sort of anti-Christmas, though, doesn't it? It's like...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't focus on anything Christmassy, if you see what I mean. It doesn't like try and bring you joy because it's Christmas or whatever. It just happens to be Christmas when the movie takes
place. I'm not sure what time of year this was released in, like, 83, but the idea that Aykroyd's dressed as Father Christmas almost seems satirical and absurd as opposed to heartwarming. Or
it was 8th of December it was released.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, checkmate.
And that's one of the reasons, also 83, it's because it's 40 years. So that's why I thought I'd chuck this one in as my choice.
Stephen has gone old school, because remember in the early days, Charlie, that we would pick an anniversary movie. That might have been why we chose it.
Possibly was, but...
Because it would be celebrating...
It was 10 years.
Yeah.
Back when you used to put some effort in,
I love this, man.
Sorry, I think we're losing his connection, aren't we?
Yeah.
You've always had a loose connection, Paul.
Right, let's sort of rewind this a little bit. This is the first time in 10 years I've watched it. I've watched it last time for the show, so this was the first time. Same for you, Paul.
Yep.
10 years. Stephen?
I watched it last year, but that's the first time I've watched it in probably 4 or 5 years.
Right, now prior to this, I used to watch this lots of times because I had the VHS. It was one of the very first VHSs I bought. Is it something that you guys may have watched, or like we're going back a little bit, you might watch a little bit more regularly?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think 80s and 90s, when there was less option of what to watch, this would have been on every year, and I'd have watched it when it came on.
Did you have a copy on video or anything, though?
Had a particular scene, or whatever I call
it. Yeah, I think...
All out.
I think
tracking,
I rented it
completely
from,
gone on it, yeah.
From who used to be before Blockbuster's video?
Oh, God. Well, used to get videos everywhere in the corner shops.
Yeah. They rented TVs and everything.
Radio
rentals.
Granada.
It's weird because like the first ever Blockbusters in the UK was the one that we went to on the Woolworth Road.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
But actually, there was... Like, and there still were. We used to just use independent ones, I think, like ones that you'd have worked in, and so I'm not sure.
No, it was I can't remember. It was one around Twiddle, but it was overtook by Rumbelows. Rumbelows, Christ, really going 80s. Yeah.
It's the Hovish music.
We've got all Picture Palace memories again, isn't it? <It's>, but you saying about that particular scene, which we will dwell on a little bit in a moment, There is, like, it's recorded in internet history that, you know, that actual scene is the most rewound and watched scene apart from what's her face that's married to Kevin Kline, Phoebe Cates in Coming Out of the Swimming Pool.
Michael Barrymore. Not Species.
No,
it's like an 80s film, isn't it? And it's like a hose or something.
Yeah,
it's like the red bikini.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the film. Phoebe Cates. Anyway, it's one of the most rewound and rewatched parts of any movie ever. And every copy that you would rent from any video store, that 10 seconds
that is
would
grim.
Be worn away to fuck.
That's grim. I didn't know that was actually a thing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, be worn away to fuck.
I wasn't as sophisticated and then off as you guys. I had it taped off the television. So I can remember all the adverts we had. But that particular scene, there's John Landis has said that when the film came out, Steve Martin has said, oh, yeah, well, I was dozing all the way through. And then suddenly I went, ooh, Jim Lucas sits. Oh, back to sleep again. So he's obviously got his interest in the film highly pinpointed at that point.
That Christopher Guest weren't happy about that remark. But
she married Christopher Guest a lot later.
Well, did she?
Yeah. Although his brother is in this, isn't he? I think he's one of the
porters.
One of Winthorpe's friends. I think he's one of those. I think.
Oh, like in the
club.
I think he's in it in some way. And also, Jamie Lee Curtis's sister is one of the friends of Winthorpe's girlfriend.
Yeah. But you're talking about John Landis. Now, around about this time, if you think, right, you've got this, the Blues Brothers before this, American Werewolf in London.
Thriller.
John Landis was on fire, surely, at this point. Why is John Landis not up there in the same echelons as like Steven Spielberg and people that we talk about nowadays? That what happened?
Sensibility. Just we'll go on to it, maybe, that there's stuff that might creak in some of his films in a way that doesn't with your Spielbergs. And I'm not saying, not turn it into a kind of a condemnation of the content, because it was of its time, but maybe it's just felt like he was not really right for the kind of Spielberg could adapt, because he could, you know, have quite a wholesome kind of content and not push the envelope a bit too much in the way that Landis did. You know,
so Landis was just that little bit left field, a tiny bit.
I think
so.
He's not quite fat. I mean, it's none of the great films that he's done you would really describe as family films, or he kind of maybe seen as a little bit too much of a maverick to be Spielberg.
Is it that same era though, guys? Isn't he? Is that early 70s going through like the George Lucas, the Steven Spielberg, you know, the
Coppola,
Easy Rider, Raging Bull sort of period, almost. Possibly like the tail end of that.
Yeah.
But it just strikes me that we don't hear from him anymore. There may be a reason, I don't know.
He's always a presence, though, as a sort of talking head, isn't he?
He's probably the best interviewee ever, isn't he?
He's so articulate and upbeat, I think. Yeah, he's not done a kind of Salinger recluse thing.
No.
He just not really wasn't getting the work in the way that the other guys were.
It just always struck me whenever you saw him on an interview, like Paul, you must have seen him on interviews. He's always got this big smile on his face.
Yeah.
And it's just, he's very pleasant. He's just like a great guy to watch, isn't he? You know, it's just like, oh, blimey, that's a great director, you know.
He loves the industry, you know, and that's why he cast Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche, because he was so much, and apparently spent a lot of time on set trying to talk to them about their careers and what was it like with so and so and what was this film like and etc. But I think you're right that his career himself is kind of pigeonholed into, you know, the this and American Werewolf and such like that he did, and then there's other stuff that he's, you know, just does things for fun now, I think,
Looking through his filmography, and he hasn't worked in about 2 or 3 years at all. I do not know any of these films apart from I've heard of the 2012 classic Attack of the 50-Foot Cheerleader.
Okay.
Did he direct that, or is he producer?
I don't know. But basically, he's not been involved in any film this century that has been of any half decent acclaim.
He's retired, isn't he?
Could be a personal situation, a bit like Rick Moranis.
Well, right, yeah. If you go back to 1994, he starred in a film called The Silence of the Hams.
Right. Okay.
I've got a funny feeling it's a Muppet thing.
I think the last sort of stuff, decent stuff he done was late 80s, early 90s.
What did he do after this, Bob?
Trading Places. He done The Muppets Take Manhattan.
There you go. I think there was a Muppet thing. That's what I
thought. Into the Night. RoboCop.
But these aren't necessarily directorial.
No, he was in RoboCop. Yeah. Eating Raoul.
Raoul.
I've seen that.
Oh, yeah. I've seen that, yeah.
I can't remember it was being any good, but...
You talking about, Stephen, earlier about Ralph Bellamy and you know, just these classic Hollywood guys. Hadn't Don Ameche disappeared off the radar?
He'd no longer got an agent. That was the thing.
But he was still living in Hollywood, wasn't he?
He was still living in Hollywood, and he was still doing the occasional, like, cameo on a TV show, just keeping his hand in. But he wasn't actually acting. He hadn't done a film for over 10 years. And because he didn't have an agent, what John Landis did was he just looked him up in the phone book, and there he was in the phone book, and just ran
under
him up.
D. Ameche, wasn't it? And he just found him, wasn't it? So, and he just leapt at the chance. And then a couple of years after this, Don Ameche gets cast in Cocoon and wins a fucking Oscar.
Right. Yeah,
yeah. The nature of the
cast.
Yeah.
Nice. It did revive a career for him, and then subsequently appeared in Coming to America. But I think this was a great spot to get him back into acting. Mm. And then we got the final few films from him, really, including Cocoon, which was some great work, actually, some of the later films.
Yeah. There.
I think he's got a Jack Lemmon-esque quality about him.
Don Ameche, well,
yeah, he's got that expression that's always kind of bemused and ready to react to something that happens.
A bit blustery sometimes as well, you know, yeah. But the double act between him and Ralph Bellamy absolutely works, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And when you look at this was like early to mid 80s, right? So these guys were at their peak 40 years before. That's the equivalent of now looking at some of our favourite 80s stars.
Yeah. So, like, who's the guy who's come back into Succession? He's in Ferris Bueller.
Exactly, because he was in that thing. Oh, yeah.
Tall, thin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cameron. I think his name was Cameron.
He plays Cameron.
Bueller, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. It's like Ruck or something, his name.
But then I'm thinking it's the equivalent of Matthew Broderick.
Yeah.
Because he's just appeared in a new Jennifer Lawrence movie.
Well, Ackroyd's coming into something now.
Yeah. And when you think back, and, you know, when we were teenagers in the 80s, sorry, Charlie, when we were teenagers, those films were 1,000 years away. Those 40s movies, you know, anything. Mm. Yeah. Black and white, absolutely. They were just ancient.
Don't forget, they are referenced. So, like in Gremlins, you'll have the mother watching. Mm. It's a Wonderful Life on TV as if it's still a long-standing tradition back then. Mm. Kind of thing. Or you'll get Home Alone.
I was
get
just about to say Home Alone.
Yeah. The homage to the kind of Warner Brothers gangster sort of flip.
But back then in 1980, we'd have seen Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche and thought, that's classic Hollywood, right? Mm. So now, if they were to make some sort of movie based, you know, similar sort of thing, and to bring back an actor from 40 years ago, it would be Matthew Broderick. It would be Harrison Ford. It would be,
kind of experiment where it's like he's trying to revive a career.
And that was one thing that was going through my mind, like watching
Rutger Hauer.
Well,
not now.
Yeah. Well, he shouldn't have been carrying around that shotgun, really, should he?
No.
You
know.
It's too much butter and bacon.
Yes, I remember the Guinness. Pure genius. I
saw one of them being filmed in Hyde Park.
Really, you were from the peak at which, although Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche started pre-Second World War, their careers really were at their peak in the 40s and 50s. Yeah. And, you know, never worked together because they were in separate studios and the studio system being what it was. But you were looking back from the date of this film being made, Trading Places, to the peak of their careers. That was 35 years. That's not as far back as what we would be doing now. This is even further away, really.
could you argue that there were more changes between that period, though, than there have been?
Well, yes, because technology-wise as well.
And like you say, the breakdown of the studio system, then the new Hollywood era, the rise of science fiction. And
I think there's more films being made by studios and independent studios. Yeah. It wasn't all just about the big two or three, was it?
But also the idea that we live in an age, and I'm sorry to kind of keep reiterating it, but there's such a lack of originality where we're trying to do the same thing again and again, where, you know, Trading Places could have feasibly been remade in the last 20 years, whereas it would have been a bit weirder to see that happening between 1943 and 1983.
I was trying to think what it reminded me of this time I watched it round, and it's things like The Prince and the Pauper, you know, where... Mm.
Got a classic
structure. Yeah, and then if you were to go into the 80s or even the 60s, actually, you know, like the body swap movies, there was this huge thing of body swap movies in the 80s,
we said before, like, where it's a period where it seemed like every film contained a character whose personality changed because they got a bump on the head,
and it was that sort of thing. But The Prince and the Pauper sort of stood out for me, where it's because it was the different class or the different level of wealth or whatever it may have been.
Yeah,
on watching it this time round, I think I realized more it's quite a moralistic story, with the fact that people, or the Dukes, are totally ruining these people's lives. And obviously, working in the homeless industry, you always have that saying of you're only two or three decisions away.
Two or three paychecks, that's what we always say. Yeah.
From being homeless and being out on the street. Mm. And the fact that two people can be so evil as to plan that for someone.
It's a bet on a dollar.
Yeah.
but it is that idea. I think, like, you get this series of films in the 80s that are very much engaging with the Reaganomics, like the kind of crude hypercapitalism of the time, where this was the first time where people were really starting to notice how cutthroat the policies and the capitalism was of the time.
And this would have been just a few years before the sort of yuppie explosion.
Yeah, before Wall Street and all that.
Yeah. And it's certainly prophesizing it.
Yeah.
If not already talking about it.
Yeah, and you got the, you know, obviously with Wall Street and stuff, you've got the, you know, Gordon Gekko, greed is good thing. And in this is the throwaway line that, you know, mother always said you were greedy, and she, you know, or she meant it as a compliment. And that is, you know, you're absolutely right that this was really the nadir of where the, well, it says in the film that this is the, you know, last bastion of capitalism is in the stock market there. And due to some, not this film directly, but due to the, some of the things that this film might have been based upon, and then a few other things that went on, there was then laws introduced to stop some of the stuff that's been done, you know, been able to be done again. And in fact, one of the clauses, I think, in one of the laws was the Murphy Law or something like that, because it was based upon Eddie.
This was brought up, wasn't it, in the Senate or something, wasn't it, as a typical example?
Sorry, what, Murphy's Law?
No, shut up.
Eddie Murphy,
There was something, Stephen, I know you're right, isn't there, mate? Yeah. Something to do with the stock, like the trading environment.
Insider trading is
And Trading Places was brought up in the Senate or whatever.
This is an example of insider trading, where they have information that they're not supposed to know before the stock market opens.
Yeah.
Mental. I mean, there was an example a couple of years before this film with the two brothers from, I think they were Brazilian, I think, or something, that the silver market had done they tried to do the same kind of thing, and it had fallen apart. But they'd not got the insider trading element. They just tried to corner the market because they thought they knew better. And then it turned out the forecasts that they were making weren't actually accurate. But adding in the element of that corruption and insider trading, that's where this, you know, this film takes the twist. And it's then the downfall of the people who are going to be doing that, and the system being used against them, which is the irony, I suppose. Capitalism not necessarily been the best thing for everybody, really.
Did everybody understand the whole mechanism of the trading side of things?
Not like, I wouldn't outside of the film, but I understood what was going on within the confines of the film. The idea of they were relying on information about the orange crop in order to kind of bring down Duke and Duke. But if you ask me to say any of that, to talk about any of the nuances of it, like, I mean, I remember watching The Big Short a few years ago, and they even kind of satirize it. There's bits where like they'll get famous celebrities that break the fourth wall and try to explain aspects.
That's right. Yeah, I remember
of the
that,
banking
yeah.
system. It'd yeah. be like Margot Robbie. It'd be yeah. Anthony Bourdain. And half the time I say, this is boring you, isn't it? Just carry on watching the film.
Like, it really doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't. The finite details aren't that important. All you need to know is that they were just fucking
they fuck you over.
Bastards. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think
it's a classic thing of short selling, I think, which is the should be banned, but it's where people are selling things that they don't actually own. Before they actually buy them, and then when you know, then they go buy them cheap and sell them at the price they've already quoted out at. Bizarre that people are allowed to get away with that kind of thing. Yeah. But that's the basics of it, the intricacies of how they manage to actually do it based upon setting the price within the bidding and waiting until a particular point before they then drop the bombshell, which destroys the price and etc. That's a bit more intricate that, as you say, going through explaining that, it would just detract from the fun of the film and seeing Ralph Bellamy have a heart attack.
But there's the cutting element where they're explaining to Valentine after he's got the job and they go through this again
because we spoke about this in the pub earlier.
They've got the, you know, oh no, sorry guys, I've already had breakfast and they've got a plate of like pork belly, they've got an orange, they've got
They've got coffee, they've got
bars of gold. So no, this isn't a meal, these are commodities, these are things that are sold on the stock market, blah blah blah. And after all the kind of explanation, there's the really famous patronizing bit, pork belly is used to make bacon, which you may find the bacon, lettuce and tomato sandwich, and
he breaks the fourth wall
like because he's so patronized. But then I think the really interesting comment after they've explained it all is they said, do you understand that? And he goes, yeah, you just had like a couple of bookies.
It's betting.
And that's all you need to know
exactly, because they will profit whatever the result of the situation. They get the
commission. And the fact is that when he's got that basic premise of what they do, he's able to actually do the job better than they, not only that they think he would be able to do, but better than anybody else who was around him, who's actually the trained people who've been doing it for years. He becomes the hanging off his word in the restaurant, and his understanding of the man on the street, and you know, like you said about people are panicking, they're just wanting to make sure they can buy their kid the G.I. Joe toy and pay for Christmas and that kind of thing. And when he's, you know, they are in the restaurant, he makes the joke about being able to pay off the jewelry for the young girlfriends, and he manages to see the system from a different angle, but he understands it better than they do. Yeah.
The con man recognising the con men, just that they've got suits.
Yeah.
When he's trying to show himself as a Vietnam veteran to begin with.
I was Agent Orange.
That made me crack up. I was Agent Orange.
Who's that? What do you want?
Police. We've had some complaints about con men pretending to be blind and crippled.
Oh, I'd love to help you, man, but I ain't seen none since I stepped on that landmine in Viet Cong back in 72. It was rough. Very painful.
You were in Nam, so were we. Where?
I was in Sang Bang, Dangong. I was all over that place, basically. A lot of places.
What unit were you in?
I was with the Green Beret, Special Unit Battalion's Commando Airborne Tactics, Specialist Tactics Unit Battalion. Yeah, it was real hush-hush. I was Agent Orange. That was my name, Agent Orange, Special Agent Orange. That was me.
Airborne, huh?
I can see! I have legs! Oh, shit, look at this! Man, I can walk! Jesus! Praise Jesus! I appreciate this. Oh, this is beautiful! I can't believe... Thank you! I don't know what to do with... Glory be to God! Praise Jesus! Look at me! This is too much! I can't believe it! I am beautiful! Listen, I can't thank you! First Moses, now this! God, Jesus! Oh, thank you! Look at me! I'm so happy. Oh, God. Look at me. This is too much. What a happy day. What a happy day. Really, I appreciate it, y'all.
Eddie Murphy's first major movie since Saturday Night Live. Is there any indication at this point that he would go on to become the superstar that he became over the next three or four years.
I think he did really show some star quality in this. He seemed much more natural. I mean, Dan Aykroyd, again, was Saturday Night Live before this, and would have done Blues Brothers.
Well, that's why he was brought on. Yeah.
But I still find Dan Aykroyd's acting quite stiff.
I think the whole film is quite stilted in that
respect, but Eddie Murphy, just natural. Yeah, and he, when he does the other character on the train, and that, it just...
Oh, the exchange student from Cameroon.
It just so smoothly goes into another role, and you don't think about it. Yeah. I mean, Dan Aykroyd trying to do the Rastafarian was cringingly bad.
That's the point.
I think he gets away with it because that's the kind of, normally you blackface and everything. Yes, even at that time, never mind looking back on it now. Even at that time, blackface, you would have gone, ooh. But because that's the kind of thing that Winthorpe as a character would have thought was acceptable. Because, you know, he uses the word Negro himself when referring to Valentine. It's something that would actually fit in with, that would, you know, he would see that as being acceptable. But as far as Eddie Murphy and, I mean, his career, yes, he'd done a film before this. He'd done 48 Hours, but...
He got a limited release though, Stephen, didn't he? I think they were really upset about the reaction to it, so it was sort of shelved and released again after this, I think.
And he only got a couple of I can't remember, it was like 100 grand or something over he got for being in that film, and that's it.
Yeah.
But this, he got $1 million dollars for being in. And then the next film, which was Beverly Hills Cop, he got $3 million for being in that. So his career just took off. But this film, I think in a lot of ways, despite the fact that it's meant to be a double header with Dan Aykroyd, and then there's, you know, great supporting cast from, you know, the others that are in it, I think it still is really, in a lot of ways, the focal point is Eddie Murphy's character. Mm. That's why he's the only one that breaks the fourth wall, because everybody else is in a different world really to the rest of us. He's the only one that's sort of looking to all of us going,
in reality,
are you seeing this, you know? And as well as the patronizing bits where he's just going,
that makes sense, doesn't it?
He's the only one who can sort of rock the foundations of this current existence, and to a lesser extent Ophelia, Jamie Lee Curtis's character. But even Ophelia is different, because she's kind of not a stereotypical kind of representation of a sex worker, in that she's got money saved, she's not a drug addict, she's got a plan. But I think the difference is with the character of Valentine is that he can see through this facade, because he himself is like a hustler and a con man.
Yeah, he's of that world, but he's on a lower level.
It's kind of the film is saying, you know, what he does is no better or no worse than what these guys are doing. They just do it in a more refined kind of sanitized showing of it. Like, they're con men themselves. They lie to people. They destroy people's lives. But it's acceptable for them to do it.
The whole concept of the movie, if we go back to the era that Don Ameche and all these guys were, you know, the 40s of the golden age of Hollywood, it's almost a typical sort of like golden age of Hollywood plot, isn't it? Where, you know, the little guy does good, basically. Exactly. Almost a Capra movie.
Yeah, I think there's that rags to riches or the turning of the tables, as you say, Prince and Pauper, and to some extent Big Meridian and stuff like that. There's a pre-war film called The Million Pound Note, which I think was
Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck, which was also had some kind of, you know, influence, I think. But as you said, the basic premise of this was classic enough that I think that's what enabled them to get Ameche and Bellamy in on it, because it was that it wasn't some of the maybe modern interpretations of a plot of a film that might have been a bit more, they're going, well, what the hell is this that I'm signing up to do? They could understand the basic premise in that sense, that it was the flipping of the social order and the bad guys getting their comeuppance and etc. So I think you're right that there's a classicness to the basic premise.
But it turns it on its head in a few ways as well. So like the example that you used of when Bellamy has the heart attack and Amici's reaction of, well, fuck him. Or the very kind of striking use of the N-word when they're in the bathroom.
Yeah.
Those are kind of
there's
just...
There's not a lot of bad language in it, but there's enough in it that would have pushed it to, what, 15 when this was released?
Pretty sure. 15,
yeah.
I think that's classic Landis.
Because Eddie Murphy goes to say motherfucker at one point and stops.
I think that's more so because he doesn't want to use that language in Coleman's presence. He's trying to kind of change his habitus and that, I think, rather than not wanting to...
I think the thing with Coleman is that there's... You can see it right from the beginning, but there's also it develops between Valentine and Coleman. I mean, right near the beginning, he's saying about, oh, maybe he should, you know, retire and go to bed and stuff like this. And, you know, he actually says thank you to him, even though he's his butler and servant and stuff. He's you know, he says, you know, thank you. And he's very much feels for him then. I think there's a connection there because you can when Coleman dumps the Crip Suzette that he's been spent time making and then has been just discarded because on whim that his effort has been just totally negated. When he goes and he throws that in the bin and then immediately he sort of with his pants still in hand he picks up the phone. He reverts to a more working class accent before he realizes who he's talking to and then poshes up again. So I think it shows that possibly Coleman's from a more working class background and that's why he's able to identify more with Valentine and subsequently being able to identify with Ophelia as well, who comes from a working class background, a you know, depressed man in town that nobody's ever heard of.
I thought that was quite Woodhouse, though. I thought I always got the air of like him being like Jeeves to Winthrop's Worcester in the sense that he bites his tongue, but there are always looks, there are always kind of certain remarks that show that he finds this whole thing ridiculous, but he still has to adhere to
one with a plan. At the end of the day, he's going to be earning his money. He's just going to bite his tongue and go through this whole process and retire 10 years time, whatever down the line. Just taking the shit.
And you get the sense that Coleman could say something to Winthrop that was totally taking the piss out of his whole existence, yet Winthrop would never actually pick up on it. That kind of, despite being the servant, you've still got some element of the upper hand there.
Yeah, because...
Well, even later on when they are actually formulating the plan and it says, you know, I think the easiest way to hurt a rich person is to make them poor. And he without thinking, goes, yeah, you've got to admit you didn't like it yourself.
Yeah. Watching this at first...
Mic drop.
I thought originally when I was watching this last night, there was some similarities between this and Arthur, you know, the John Gielgud being the
similar
butler.
Similar time as well.
It's similar, but it isn't because Arthur... Like when Gielgud's butler genuinely cares for Arthur.
In that sort of remains of the day kind
He's grown up with him and he's always been a presence in his life. And it's not been anything apart from, you know, he's actually been an uncle. He's been a father figure to him, you know. And Coleman in this particular case is completely opposite. But
I think with Coleman, he is... probably just been in that position with various different people.
He's been employed by the Dukes. He's employed
by the Dukes, lives in that house and serves whoever is managing director at that time.
Exactly. So therefore he knows you're nothing that special.
I've seen a dozen of you guys go through him. But at first I was thinking, oh, this is a bit like Arthur, but it's nothing like Arthur when you see the relationship between John Gielgud and Dudley Moore.
The only similarity with Arthur would be the kind of naivety of Winthrop and Arthur's character, not realizing how fragile the rest of the world is and how lucky they are.
The butler's always the more intelligent and the more, you know,
more savvy.
Yeah, of all of them. Yeah.
Well, in this case, the denouement have been able to actually overthrow the Dukes and do what they did to them. The only way that's possible is due to the money that has been honestly earned by the two, you know, Ophelia and Coleman are the two that's actually earned their money and got it the hard way. But, you know, they're the ones that obviously finance and make the difference. And it's you know, that honesty to where the money has come from actually then being used to overthrow the people who've corruptly earned it is fairly poignant, I think.
I think that's something that I never really regarded, but I think it's such a good point. Yeah.
Well, they also had the 100 grand from the payoff for the Orange report.
Yeah.
Because he slid in the suitcase with the 100 grand in, so they used that.
Yeah, there was.
But there's that thing, he said, there's £42,000 I've worked hard for that. Please look after that for me. Yeah.
And she's been on her back for the rest of it.
Yeah. Such a great movie. I mean, originally, I mentioned this to the guys earlier in the pub, Stephen, that Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor were considered.
I just can't see them working together, them two.
I could definitely see Richard Pryor in the Eddie Murphy role.
Yes.
I don't know that Gene Wilder would have pulled off the posh as well as...
There's a phrase.
You've got to move your senses quicker.
There's too much sort of kindness in Gene Wilder's face to kind of have the detached, ignorant kind of. I think he could have done it.
I think he could have done. Gene Wilder's brilliant.
The film is, and obviously Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor is just stunning kind of collaboration through the years. But I think the film is better for the dynamic of Aykroyd and Murphy. And you know, when you hear about certain decisions in cinema and TV history, like, it was going to be this guy, it was going to be them, and you think, I'm so glad it wasn't.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, you can't say because you haven't seen it, but I just think the Aykroyd and Murphy dynamic is absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
I agree. I think that they're younger as well, and I think that also helped that they managed to push it across. I do agree with what you said about Gene Wilder having more innocence to him or nicety to him to not be able to pull off the callousness of but just while we're talking about alternative castings, one of the things was that they had instead of for Coleman, they had John Gielgud was one option, and they also had Ronnie Barker.
Am I right, Stephen? Ronnie Barker stipulated he would not work more than 7 miles away from his home.
That was the reason
Ronnie Barker said I would not work.
It's annoying because he only lives 8 miles outside of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But that would have been amazing. But Ronnie Barker, apart from Porridge the movie, never starred in any real sort of, you know, it'd have been brilliant.
He was, but Denham Elliott's superb.
And John Gielgud would have been absolutely perfect as well in that role. Which I think is why Gielgud probably headed towards Arthur. Must have been after this, isn't it? A year or so after this.
Well, so the Arthur sequel's 88.
Yeah. So the first one's
got to be around 84. When did the Christopher Cross song come out?
It's got to be 84.
Yeah. We're going into Ken Bruce territory.
Yeah.
That was late 80s, wasn't it?
But
Mac Dowder make it.
That was early 90s, Chris Cross.
But we always dwell on, you know, what ifs and, you know. Is it the perfect cast? Because Eddie Murphy, they took a gamble almost because it was just based on Saturday Night Live. No, you know.
It's full of performances that don't let the film down and doesn't present an obvious weak link. I think everyone does a lot of heavy lifting to make this film as good as it is.
Jamie Lee Curtis was perfect because she had an amazing body, which was...
Let me finish. Yeah.
She had the amazing body. But she also wasn't a bimbo of an actress. She actually could act.
We had this discussion earlier about Jamie Lee Curtis where we said that she has obviously enormous sexual energy in this film.
Enormous one.
But in other films, she can play a character who isn't remotely sexualized. Yeah. She has that diversity as an actress where she's not just, you know... She has that ability.
She turned down Psycho 2 because obviously her mother was in Psycho. And she turned down Psycho 2 because she didn't want to be cast as a scream queen. Stephen, I'm right on this one.
She already was because of what she'd already done. She was seen as that was all she could do. And John Landis saw that she had, you know, this amazing potential for comic timing and being able to do that. So he fought and fought and fought to get her in this and obviously was absolutely right to do so. And she'd been, you know, proven since then. Her acting talent is there, and I mean, okay, she can return to parts like this where she's playing that sexual intensity, such as, you know, with Fish Called Wanda and True Lies, I forgot about True Lies, but there's other bits like Charlie said where she's playing more dowdy or playing more straight or playing more tough, and that that her range, we probably would never have got to see all the stuff that she subsequently done if it wasn't for this film. And yeah, you know, that, all the things I've seen with regards to this film from the obviously not Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy, but all the Aykroyd and Murphy particularly, but also herself, she's, you know, saying about all of them really look back on this film as being, you know, something they're incredibly proud of and enjoyed. Eddie Murphy said it was the last time he enjoyed actually making a film. But it's, you know, a lot of the time when people make films earlier on in their careers, they might look back and go, oh, I'm not really that proud of it, or I don't really want to talk about it. Or
Because you're a different person.
Whereas Jamie Lee Curtis and Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd, in interviews when talking about this film, they seem to light up and just, you know, they're really proud of what they did and how much they enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, because Dan Aykroyd's very recently spoken about this film in the last few months. And as you can imagine, he was asked about the blackface element.
Yeah.
And he said, I think he was telling that, he said, well, I wouldn't do that now. But he wasn't anachronistic, and he didn't go back and say we were disgusting for doing that. It showed you that he was still fond of this as a piece of work, yeah, and that he was, you know, he didn't come out and defend it per se, but I don't think he should have necessarily had to, because I do think you hit the nail on the head and said it is actually quite relevant to the character and the plot, yeah, and not just a device to mock African American
people, totally pivotal to the plot.
Yeah, it's not there to make the ethnic minority the butt of the joke, in my opinion.
Apart from the fact that he's funny.
No.
Yeah.
And it is funny, but I think this is a rarity to some extent for films at this point in the early 80s, in that a lot of comedies that came out in the early 80s, and you can include films that I adore, you know, some of the John Hughes stuff and things like that, a lot of them don't necessarily portray women. I mean, you know, some of the John Hughes films, if you look back, you're going, that's a bit dodgy with regards to its representation of women and particularly young women being sexualized and stuff. But this film, I think, the Jamie Lee Curtis character, because it shows her to be not just a tart with a heart, but also with brains. I mean, you know, she... not to get into to language, but you know, she owns her own means of production to actually make her well.
we're actually going to do Stephen Bingo and see when means of production.
Yeah.
If number two comes up, or you know,
That's it.
Mingles gets a mention.
There's also in this that I think it's quite positive.
She has agency, doesn't she? That's the thing.
She does have agency, yeah. And I think also it also gives a lot towards. Despite the use of Negro and the N-word.
But those are characters that you aren't supposed to...
Yes. Later on, I mean, right, the denouement of the film, when it's they're actually talking to the Dukes and saying about the fact that they made this bet, he's saying, you know, Aykroyd's character, Winthorpe, he turned around and says, oh, well, Valentine said, you know, bet me that we could... get rich and make you poor at the same time. I didn't believe him, but he was right. And it's giving him the credit for the idea at that point, even though it was probably more Winthorpe in some ways. But it could quite easily be carrying on being this, you know, still the white guy who's saving the day. But right, it's actually scoring an extra point with the Dukes that, you know, it's the black guy that beat you, that you were being so disparaging about. And you know, same as disparaging with the guy in the club where they give him his Christmas bonus of $5.
Half of that's from me.
Maybe I'll go to the movies on my own. I think there's, as you said, and also, you know, despite the fact that Valentine is coming from a street con man thing, he's begging for money under false pretenses. He's not robbing people. He's not dealing drugs, you know, and in actual fact, there's a point made later on about the drug side of things that, you know, he says about a stand against that kind of thing. But he's actually, again, you know, painted in a fairly positive light compared to what he could have been and what some other films would have done around this area. The agency of them and actually showing that, yeah, he's had a a disadvantaged star, but he actually understands the system better than they do once it's the basics are explained, and actually, you know, shows that their only advantage was they got the better start, and he's actually cleverer than they are. That's rare for a film, I think, of this era, because a lot of the time they did get the cheap laughs and go down the very much stereotype of women and ethnic minorities, unfortunately.
I thought it was telling as well that, like, Bellamy's character out of the two of them is more interested in, like, the sociological side of things. And he's, like, got this fascination with the nature versus nurture argument. But he's got such a kind of basic, rudimentary kind of grasp of it that he says to Valentine, like, well, obviously you're black, like, obviously you must have had several offences related to drugs, and you must have been in and out of prison and gone in care home. So even when he's sort of trying to understand it, he's doing it in a really shallow kind of patronising and dismissive way.
And you came from a broken home, and he goes, yeah, we were broke. and it is absolutely right that despite Ralph Bellamy, maybe not his character not being as openly nasty, he still is underneath it all, obviously, you know. But that's one of the things about this film. It's not just on the face of it what it is. There's lots of these, like, Easter egg things in the background when you're watching that, you know, obviously lots of other films that we love have this as well. That means you can rewatch it and rewatch it and rewatch it. And there's, when Ralph Bellamy's at one point, he's got one of the presidents as a picture behind him, as opposed to when Don Ameche is, it's Richard Nixon, showing the levels of corruption in different ways, still corrupt, but in different ways. And that's also the same with when they're trying to entrap Valentine by dropping the money clip, and he picks it up and for a moment thinks, oh, this is good, and then thinks, no, I need to be honest about this. And behind him, there's George Washington's portrait, which obviously the whole, you know, I cannot lie. And so there's lots of little bits like that thrown in that, you know, you look in the background, seeing these bits and pieces, including some of the director trademarks, such as See You Next Wednesday poster. But
right. See You Next Wednesday, which we know appears in every John Landis movie. For the first time, I noticed that was like a reproduction of like a proper movie poster this time.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the cast list underneath, it was Merle Oberon and Laurence Olivier, which I'm assuming must be Wuthering Heights, might have been. But before it was a porno movie, wasn't it, in American Werewolf?
Because he's in the porno cinema.
Yeah, and it's called See You Next Wednesday.
Isn't it in Thriller?
Because that's what they said at the Thriller, where you see Michael Jackson in the audience, is "See you next Wednesday," and it's that whole thing that Landis has going for him. But this time, I just noticed there was a genuine original sort of movie poster that just had "See You Next Wednesday" superimposed over the top of it. It's in the tube. It's in the underground pool. Tottenham Court.
don't even go there.
Just reminds me, you mentioning American Werewolf. Originally, Landis wanted Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy to be playing the two lead parts in American Werewolf.
Really?
That would have been a very different film.
And they say it would have been a different film. You've got a world where Trading Places, Coming to America, and American Werewolf all happen within the same world, and to some extent Blues Brothers
as well,
within the same world as each other, which means Rick Mail sat in that pub in the middle of Yorkshire happens the same world as Prince Hakim and Winthrop and the Blues Brothers. So it's nice to say, actually, Blues, just talking the Blues, nice to see cameo from Bo Diddley doing the
in the jail cell, Giancarlo Esposito
very young.
Another Blues Brother connection then, because
Belushi,
James Belushi
originally dressed up as the thriller ape, isn't he, at the end?
He was in Blues Brothers 2000, which was shocking, which was also John Landis,
costume, not the one that Belushi's in, but the one that
it wasn't a real one.
No, not like a gremlin. No. And I'm convinced, I looked this up on the internet to try and see if this was right. Do you remember Dino De Laurentiis did a remake of King Kong?
Right.
1976. Jessica Lange and Jeff Bridges and all that. And most of the
the monkey effect was a man in an ape suit.
Yeah, just made to look much bigger. Yeah.
I'm convinced that is the suit.
Oh.
I think I've
read somewhere that actually.
Is that right? Because I couldn't find anything online last night, mate, and I'm convinced that is the same monkey suit.
I think I've either read it or seen it in a, because a few years ago I did watch accidentally, because I thought it was the actual film I was looking up rather than it was the making of Trading Places, which was like, it's only about 12 minutes long or something of, and I think it was in there or something else I've read somewhere that there's some, it's either using that exact suit or they're reproducing that suit.
Right, because it did look familiar. It really did look familiar. Not that it was realistic compared to the Belushi suit, which is the idea, isn't it? It's supposed to be, that's a real, you know, gorilla sitting there and James Belushi's wearing a fancy dress costume.
More realistic than the accent of an Austrian being Swedish.
Yes. Yeah, total misconception there. I did like the beaks winding the ape up though, through the window, and then they're coming back on him, literally.
The actor beaks.
Breakfast Club.
Right,
the teacher.
Yes, I was going to say I've seen him before, and it's like he's another one of those that probably appears in loads of films as the bit part.
Die Hard is the cop.
Oh, okay.
The Al Powell is there, you know, and he's like, you know, get me a real police officer.
He's a very steady actor all the way through all the stuff he's in. Very similar parts, to be fair, but to do exactly what he's expected to do, he does it well, with not much variation, but still. It's, as you say, number one, just doing exactly what was called for the parts, and then. And say all the background, there's various people, cameos or brothers of people, or the one of the producers as a, you know, makes a cameo in this and all sorts of things. So
have we missed anybody out cameo wise or sort of supporting cast that we haven't mentioned?
John Landis is in it on the stairs when he's coming out after he's been arrested, and he comes out, he stood on the steps talking to one of the group of people.
I wondered if he was in it, because he tends to be Hitchcock, doesn't
and,
he
and when you go when Winthorpe is first, I think, arriving at work. The first person who says hello to him and takes his coat off him, that's one of the producers.
Of
the film. That's the only. It's the only time he's actually made a cameo in a film as well, apparently. So. But no, a lot of it is, like you said, people you go and subsequently see them in other things, their careers. You know, they started in this and then took off.
Yeah. So we're talking about a 40-year-old movie this year? Sure. How's it stand up this time, guys? You know, we can talk about the uncomfortable elements of this, but I don't think we have to, because we could have this conversation every time we talk about a movie of this time and this era, and it's of its time, okay? So we've got the blackface, we've got the offensive language. Apart from all that, because we could, you know, we have this same conversation. As a movie, did we enjoy it? Does it stand up? Will we watch it again? Is it a classic comedy?
Yes, to all four of those questions.
Yes, to all
four.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. But also, the thing of its time is particularly important here, because you have to place it in the context of what was happening in capitalist America. You know, it's fundamental that it's set in Philadelphia. The opening scene is literally showing you scene by scene the juxtaposition between the haves and the have-nots.
Absolutely, yeah.
And therefore, everything that in this film that might seem a little dicey to someone who doesn't know about that era is actually justified, I think.
Yeah. Did you notice the Rocky statue at the beginning?
I did, I did.
Before it was moved,
To show people playing, like, basketball at the end of a street where every house is boarded up, and then having, like, you know, contrasting it with signs saying liberty and justice for all and the great architecture of that city. I think it's very, very loaded in what it's doing.
Also, the sort of dilapidation of the statues of these once great people, you know, is this part of it as well, you know?
Yeah.
Philadelphia was, you know, the heart of, you know, liberty a new now, continent and all this lot. And it's just, this looks a bit tired now. Things are not as it were, you know. But at the same time, like you said, you've got these two different worlds going on
There's just enough of a social conscience about the film for it to get away with anything that might be considered a little bit.
Yeah.
I see.
You ain't seen it for 10 years.
No. I think the only thing that surprised me about it this watch was there's a lot of setting of the story, which is very much needed.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it as a comedy, the first probably 40 minutes, 45 minutes isn't that funny, because it's set in the scene for when the real humorous stuff happens.
The wackiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, it becomes a different kind of comedy, actually.
So, if I was recommending that to someone today that hasn't seen it, that's like in their 20s or 30s,
they would be expecting a laugh. Yeah.
Have to say, bear with the first 45 minutes. It is set in the scene. Watch it all the way through.
But it doesn't have to be like laugh after laugh after laugh, no, does it?
When something's your favourite comedy film, say someone likes Airplane or from the word go, that is stupid joke after stupid joke.
I totally agree with Paul in that. It's actually a very stilted film to begin with, even to the point where there's not a lot of actual physical movement.
But it is a comedy, isn't it? Even from the beginning, despite what you're saying, it is still a comedy.
But it does become that way. It suddenly turns into a thing where there's a New Year's Eve party on a fucking train. Do you know what I mean? Yes. It goes from being very stilted to very frenetic.
How many times were they playing Locomotion on that train? Every time they walked through the car that had the party going on, it was playing Locomotion.
Lots of royalties for Carole King.
I was going to say,
until I read the credits at the end, I never knew Carole King wrote that.
She wrote it for her nanny, I believe.
I think it was.
Chin Pan Alley.
Stephen, why did you choose this movie originally? Was it just because we hadn't seen it for a while? Was it because it was the anniversary, like you said? Or was it just, that's a great movie, let's have another go at this?
Well, you know, you make comment, you know, very rightly about me and my list of films. And when you kindly invited me to come on and review one that you previously done, I managed to narrow it down to 10. This was on the 10. And when I went through, I started thinking about, you know, there was a few things like Grapes of Wrath and other things like that. And I thought, you know, I'd like to talk about this because it's something I do genuinely adore. It's something I've watched over and over and over because I taped it off television when I was young. And it's one of the few films that I actually had to watch. So I watched it repeatedly when I was younger. Not just one part of it either. It was the entire film. But then, you know, along with that, realizing it was the 40th anniversary, it just started steamrolling to this was the obvious choice that I enjoy this film. And because I'd watched it last year, I did realize that for me, it stands the test of time. It's, you know, everything, if you watch it in context, as Charlie was saying before, that, you know, whether it's the language, the blackface, the fact that this was really the divergent point where the gap between rich and poor really started widening to an exponential point. This all came together, and because I'd watched it again late last year and realised that it still did work and there's still so many levels to it, and it's still very clever, not just in the plot, but in the way it was made, I felt it stood the test of time enough for us to be able to revisit it as a group of us now and actually have quite a bit to talk about, to be perfectly honest.
An almost sensible conversation at just some point.
And it goes against what I've previously said. It's very difficult, I find, to review comedies.
Yes.
Because you find yourself just reciting.
We haven't recited a single word, have we?
No.
Pretty much. I cheated it by doing the bacon lettuce.
Yeah, but we haven't done the airplane thing.
We've done airplane. The Airplane review was about half hour long because you can't really talk. There's not much plot to it, really.
It's so difficult.
And you just find yourself saying one funny line after another. Whereas this was a story-led comedy. So I think this was much easier to review. And as I said, the comedy didn't even particularly start for the first sort of 40 minutes or so.
There's a very, not necessarily complex story, but there's a very involved story that takes you from A to B to C to D all the way through.
This could have been a movie without the comedy. Yeah. This could have been a serious movie on the fact that people were made to be down on their luck and then came back.
Mm.
So,
and in the hands of a different director or screenwriter. It probably would have been,
Yeah.
And it could have also been a lot heavier in, although, you know, I do like the message that it has in it. It's not completely in your face and the sole purpose of the film. It's it, And that, as you say, in a different director's hands and with different actors, could quite well have not worked, or it could have just been, you know, a lot more punching you in the face with what it was trying to say, rather than it actually saying that as a byproduct of actually having a good story. So I think you picked up rightly on that.
So an all-round genuine thumbs up.
I think it was always going to be, wasn't it? It's a reappraisal as opposed to a response.
It's just difficult not to like it, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, so, I should say not a reappraisal, but it's just a reaffirmation of what we think of a great film.
I don't think we've ever, you know, in the last review, we didn't hate it. We probably said a lot more this time round, actually, compared to...
Having Stephen on as well has had, like, allowed us
no,
to...
No, ignore him. Don't worry about him. He just,
but, like, you know, like, I can... the more talking to you about it, the more I realise why it kind of holds a bit more of a place in your heart as well, because it is quite, like, without being like hit it like a sledgehammer with a walnut, it is quite politically charged in a weird way as well. Like, it's,
but also,
you can,
I
enjoy
think...
it on multiple levels. This, you can just watch it as just a comedic film where there's, you know, rags to riches or the turning of the tables, and just watch it at that. Then you can read the other bits into it if you really want to, as well as enjoying the performances, looking for the Easter eggs, all these kind of things. So it works on multiple levels, I think, as this film.
Yeah. I mean, I think the AFI, the American Film Institute, have got in like the top 10 comedies.
Right.
Yes or no, you know, we could debate that later, but it is still a bloody great film and a bloody great comedy. There's little for us. I didn't feel uncomfortable with the blackface and the use of the language and stuff like that, because I knew
we just clicked that and used that as a general sort of quote from Scott and put it in any
context. To be honest,
Scott relished the blackface.
Yeah. Scott watched blackface.
Very often on a Saturday night, that's what he's wearing. And I'm glad he's got it on tonight as well. I'm glad he's got it on tonight.
Yeah. And I don't think it should be.
Some stuff creaks. And then some stuff is
this
like,
this doesn't creep to me.
Like Ackroyd said, he wouldn't do it now.
Yeah.
But that's not him saying that he feels that it was unjustified at the time. There's no way it would be done now. But it's a different era.
Ackroyd cites this, Ghostbusters and Dragnet, I think, as his three favourite movies.
Dragnet.
Yeah.
That's the facts.
Yeah. And now, preview time. When it comes to entertainment, you can't beat a good film. So let's take a look at what's coming your way.
I've asked the boys to come up with a movie. Paul can be asked. So Charlie's come up with something that we're going to review. We're going to invite you back, despite what they're saying. We're going to invite you back. Charlie, what you got in mind, mate?
I'm going for a 1986 film. Directed by Oliver Stone.
Okay.
Starring James Woods, Jim Belushi and John Savage.
Salvador. I don't think I've seen it.
I've never heard of it. But with that cast and that director, I don't know why.
Stephen must have seen it.
I have, but I think I've only seen it once, to be fair.
Yeah.
So
it's a good one.
Okay.
Yeah. Interested in that.
Here we go. See, we've got something right today.
Oh, we haven't reviewed it yet.
No, we'll have to see what happens.
I didn't really know anything about it until I read Oliver Stone's memoir that came out about 3 years ago. No, I've watched it subsequently. That was what introduced him, and he always feels like it's a bit of a bugbear of his that it didn't get the kind of response that he felt it deserved in comparison to something like Platoon or JFK.
I like that.
Intrigued.
Yep.
Look forward to seeing it again.
Yeah.
Let's just thank Stephen once more. Stephen, thank you so much, mate. I know you got to rush off at some point to. Are you going to Manchester Airport now?
Yeah.
The enthusiasm there. You're going to pick up your beloved because you've missed her.
Yeah.
You're fine. She doesn't listen to this. You're
fine. Oh, no, she's, you know, it's how it works. You know, I'll get messages from her to say, it says to people, we try and have like Friday evening together, and sometimes I'll get a message saying, oh, there's some tennis on tonight. And I'll go, Oh, okay, I will come round then, and that's the message on that. And, and then I have before I had a message that just says, I can't be bothered with you tonight. Can we leave? Alright then. So, and then I have also gone round, sat there, we've had something to eat, and she's gone, are you going home now? Yeah, it looks like it, doesn't it? So, can you, so it's very honest in that sense. So,
can you send her a text now saying, I can't be fucking bothered to pick you up, bitch? Just as I said, make your own way,
aren't
you? Yeah, get a car. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to pick her up, and I've gone and, got her some food, so she's got something to eat in the car on the way back. But I'll be paying for the petrol, and they'll be paying for the fee of actually getting into the airport. So, and that she's the one that gets the joy of the holiday. It's a good job she's taking me to fucking Cuba, isn't it? Because otherwise,
that's communism.
Spending her inheritance on me. How dare she?
Again, love you so much, mate. Thank you. It's been a real
great to see you again, Stephen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you too as well, all three of you. And obviously, I'll see Scott soon, but hopefully, I'll see the you two.
We'll do it again
before sooner rather than later.
Yeah,
we'll try and do it again before Christmas, if not earlier.
Even if it's just not recording, and having a stupid quiz.
Actually, that might be a better
sounds
idea.
Like fun.
Who wants to do a podcast anyway? Fuck it. This has been the Stinking Pools. Guys, take care. See you all later.
Bye.
Ah.
Take care.
The management of this theater suggests that for the greater entertainment of your friends who have not yet seen the picture, you will not divulge to anyone the secret of the ending.
Astrid Arms, that infernal jamboree is worse than two cats on a fence.
You dudes get lost now, you hear?
Good night, ladies.
Good night, sir.
When you feel down, try positive thinking. That's what I told the man said. Don't wear a frown, try positive thinking, laugh at your troubles instead. You've got to look on the bright side, on hope so much depends. With your confidence sinking, positive thinking helps you on the way, my friend. When things look black, try positive thinking, treat every season as spring. No glancing back, try positive thinking, trust what tomorrow may bring. This crazy world that we live in will keep on spinning round, but with good, strong, positive thinking, we'll get together and life won't let us down.
Shut up, you ugly bitch.
Oh, shut up, we enjoy it.